In 2007, on CBS Radio's The Fan Show, David Morris spoke about local self-reliance, offered a bottom-up energy strategy, and proposed an effective populist strategy for reducing climate change.
We're joined in this portion of our program by David Morris. David is Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's joining us on our program to talk with us about some issues surrounding the topic of energy, which is something that has been very much in focus this year with a lot of people when, of course, they've gone to the gas pump and gotten that shock at various points throughout the year. David, in his background, has been an advisor to the energy departments of Presidents Ford, Carter, Lincoln, Ford, Carter, Clinton, and George W. Bush. He currently serves on a federal advisory council created by Congress to advise secretaries of energy and agriculture on energy policy. Now, one of the things that, as I understand, you argue, David, and it's nice to have you join us on our program.
Thank you.
I understand that you argue for the idea of what's referred to as a bottom-up energy policy. I want to get into talking about that and get an explanation from you of exactly what that means. But for some of the people who are listening to us, they heard me mention the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and will wonder, what exactly is that?
Well, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance was set up in 1974, and we have offices now in Washington, D.C., and in Minneapolis, and in Portland, Maine. And our philosophy is pretty simple, and that is that most of the world's problems can and should be solved from the bottom up. And what we do is we focus on ways in which communities can get the most from their local resources before they depend on more remote resources. And by resources, I mean human resources, capital resources, their political authority, their natural resources. And we work in a number of different areas, you know, everything from cities establishing their own telecommunications networks, much the way they have their roads, to cities and regions establishing energy self-reliance. We're not the Institute for Local Self-Sufficiency. We're not we don't believe in autarky and isolationism, but we do believe that there's a great deal more independence that we can exercise, and that when we rely on systems that increasingly are characterized by structures where those who make the decision are not those who feel the impact of the decision. When the producer of a product or a service is located thousands of miles away from the consumer of that product and services, there's a lot of bad things that happen. And so in the old Buddhist economics expression, transportation is a necessary evil, but it should be viewed as an evil, and wherever possible, we should rely on ourselves.
And key to that way of thinking, as I understand it, is also the idea of, when it comes to energy, specifically looking at renewable forms of energy?
Yes, what we do is, I mean, with every policy, we would look at something from the bottom up and see how much of the problem we can solve from the bottom up. So we actually started we're founded in 1974, and 1974 was the launching of the Project Blueprint Independence, which was the result of the oil embargo and the price shock of 1973 or in early 1974. And so we looked at the energy picture, and from our own template, from our own screen, we said, well, let's first inventory what we have available to us. So that included the fact that we have a great deal of heat under the ground, just under the freeze line. So in Minnesota, that means several miles down, of course. And in Alabama, it means a few inches down. No, just kidding. It's maybe 4 feet down in Minnesota. And at that point, the Earth is about 55, 57 degrees warm year-round. So that means if you have to heat your home to to 68 degrees, you just have to bump up that already freely available heat by another 10 degrees. And so, you know, one can provide most of our heat from the ground. And then one looks and sees that there's enough sunlight, that is solar energy, that falls on our rooftops and our buildings in almost all places in the country, except for very high-density, you know, skyscraper places like Manhattan, to provide us all the energy we need year-round to not only run our house, but also to run the family electric car. And then we look at the winds, the movement of air molecules, and we see that not that far from our buildings, usually within 50 or 100 miles of our buildings, sometimes in the backyard if we're in suburban or rural areas, there's enough wind to provide all of our electricity needs as well. And then we look at plant matter, and we realize that the plant matter that grows in the rural areas relatively near where we live can provide not only fuel, but can provide the basis for a substitution for things like petrochemicals. That is, we can make plastics out of sugars and out of starches. We don't have to make them out of petroleum. So if you inventory your resources, what you realize is that in theory, and when I say in theory, I mean given the amount of energy that is available and given the technologies that are currently available in terms of conversion efficiencies, we can in theory be self-sufficient. Now, not that we're going to be self-sufficient, but we can in theory be that. So what we then do is say, well, given that possibility, how do we design policies on the local, state, and national and international level that guides entrepreneurial energy and investment capital and scientific genius in the directions of building those kinds of systems? And we have a website, newrules.org, and we call it New Rules because we think that the rules that we make, whether they're policy, regulations, statutes, tax incentives, or the like, guides human genius. And for the last 100 years, the rules that we've made have created long-distance transportation systems and absentee-owned structures. But those are not inevitable. They're things that happen because we made the rules.
Let me ask you for a moment or two about a recent report that you did. It kind of ties as well into some of what you've shared with us here. I think people listening to us would be very interested in your thoughts that were contained in A Better Way to Get from Here to There, which was a report out recently. What motivated that report?
Well, that report actually was done in late 2003, and we're in the process of updating it. And what prompted it was the sudden infatuation of the country with hydrogen. The president had in early 2003 had said we're going to move toward a hydrogen economy, and we looked at that, and it didn't make sense from just about any perspective. It meant sort of recreating everything. You had to create new energy systems, and you had to create new distribution systems, and you had to create new cars and new engines and new filling stations. And my goodness, it was just changing everything wasn't going to be able to happen within at least two generations and probably three. So then we looked and said, well, what is available? And just at that moment, this is 2004. The second generation Prius was coming into the marketplace, that is the hybrid. And suddenly, hybrids, which, by the way, are now just a little less than 3% as of last month of new vehicle sales, that is light vehicle sales, they began to take America by storm. And the hybrid is a new technological structure. That is, it is capable of propelling the car by a motor, propelling the car by an engine. Now, the current hybrids are the battery is only recharged by the engine, and the reason that you get savings in gas mile or gasoline is that when you're stopped at a light, everything kicks off, and so you're not idling with your engine. And when you start off, which is a moment where you both are generating a lot of pollution and the engine operates quite inefficiently, you accelerate initially with your motor, not with your engine. So that combination of those two actually saves you energy, which is why the Prius, by the way, gets better mileage in the city than it does on the highway, whereas all of your internal combustion engine cars, as people know, you have an EPA rating highway and city, and you'll get better on the highway than you will on the city. But the Prius is just the opposite because of the ways it works. Well, if you look at that technological platform, you say, well, there it is. Now let's just see how we can build on that. And one way to build on that is to put a socket in the side of the car, and a number of people have done that increasingly. And you can now charge the car, not from the engine, but from the electric grid system, and then add battery capacity so that the car can travel on electricity for a significant distance, 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles. And then take the engine that's there, and hybrids, of course, have an engine, and make it a flexible fueled engine, which means that you can run it on anything from 100% gasoline to 100% ethanol or biofuel or biodiesel. And then what you end up with is a dual-fueled transportation system in which electricity will be the primary fuel. And the reason it'll be a primary fuel is because people will prefer to use electricity because the cost of electricity per mile is about a penny, and the cost of gasoline or ethanol per mile is now about 12 or 13 cents. So people would prefer to maximize their use of electricity whenever they can, but they don't have to worry about exhausting the battery because then the engine kicks in. And when they drive on electricity, they're not using oil because we don't use oil in this country to generate electricity. We use a lot of other things, but we don't use oil. And when they drive on their engine, they will be using virtually no oil because they'll rely on biofuels. And so what you have there is an oil-free, not a pollution-free, but it can end up there, but an oil-free transportation system. And the final point of this is that, of course, on the electricity side, 50% of our electricity is generated right now from coal. But increasingly, we're passing laws at the state level. The federal government hasn't done it yet. That requires an increasing percentage of our electricity to come from renewables. And renewable electricity, like solar cells and wind turbines, have their own shortcoming, which is that they're intermittent. A wind doesn't blow all the time, and the sun doesn't shine all the time. So they need a storage system. Well, my goodness, if you have an electric vehicle with a large battery, that's your storage system. And so when the wind blows and the sun shines, you will be storing up the electricity, and then you can use it at any time. So that's what a better way taught people. And since December 2003, when it was issued, it has become almost mainstream. Really, in 2007, people are increasingly talking about it. But it's a system that relies on current technology. When it comes to electricity, we have the distribution system. There's a socket everywhere. So unlike hydrogen or something else, we don't have to invent new distribution systems. And it could come into effect very quickly.
We hear so much these days, David, and we're talking with Dr. David Morris, who is Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's joined us by phone on our program. I'm Bob Salter. We hear so much talk about this issue of global warming. It's interesting how mainstream the discussion of global warming has become, and also interesting the approaches that seem to be being taken. One thing that I had read in a recent piece that you had been involved in doing is talking about the idea of capping emissions as a way to address this climate issue. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, people should realize that we are moving in this direction. That is, unlike a year ago, or especially 2 years ago, we were still fighting about whether there is global warming. That fight is now over, and every government is saying, even the Bush government is saying, we are going to reduce it. And the argument is, well, how do you do that? And at the state level, there are now about a dozen states that are implementing strategies for reducing carbon emissions. And so right now, the question is, how do we do that? And there are a number of different suggestions, but to me, the only way you can guarantee a reduction is to demand a reduction. And you demand a reduction by saying we will cap the amount of emissions that we allow to be emitted, and then we will ratchet that down. Now, people might say, "Oh my God, what are you talking about? You're going to have somebody who looks at my tailpipe every day, or checks my smokestack or my chimney, or something like that?" No, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is that the providers of fossil fuels, that is carbon-based fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal, they will have to buy permits based on the amount of carbon emissions that will occur from their selling their fuels. And so they will have to buy these permits. And each year that there are fewer permits available, presumably two things will be happening. One is that the price of those permits will go up, and all those increased costs will, of course, be passed on to the customers. So you'll see the price of gasoline and electricity, at least fossil fuel, derived electricity and the like, go up. And the other thing that will happen is that there'll be more and more incentive for renewables and energy efficiency to come into the marketplace, and so it provides a good price signal. So we argue that a cap is essential if we're seriously going to get from here to there. If we're not serious, we can do just about anything. We can double the efficiency of cars in the next 15 or 20 years, which is what Congress is debating and probably isn't going to end up doing because it's too radical. But even if we did double the efficiency of cars, let's say in the next 15 years, I think that's what's on the table, you still end up with a fleet of cars that it would take 25 more years to turn over completely. And so you don't actually get to a significant reduction because people are driving more, there are more of us, we have more cars on the road. So that's a good thing to do, but it isn't, the only way we can get there from here is to insist that there's an auction, there's a quota, and we can draw down on that. Now, if we agree with that, and most people at least are willing to entertain that, then the question is, what do we do with the money that's generated from the buying of those permits? And this is a lot of money. I mean, in my state alone, it would be at least $1 billion a year. That's Minnesota, which is 2% of the population. So figure that it would be $50 billion a year in the United States. So that's how much would be generated. And then the question is, well, what do you do with that? And we come at that with our local self-reliance philosophical principle, which is that the biosphere belongs to everybody equally. That is, we're not banning the emissions of carbon because it's part of the natural cycle. We are saying that there's only a certain carrying capacity of the biosphere, so we're limiting it. We're providing a quota of dumping, a dumping quota, if you will. And that quota should be allocated, or the value of that quota should be allocated equally to everybody on Earth. But if we're going to start in Minnesota or New York or the nation, then we start there, and that means that money should go back on a per capita basis to everyone. So what happens there is an interesting dynamic occurs, and that is that you pay higher prices because of the carbon permits have to be purchased, and that'll roll through to the price of gasoline and the price of electricity and home heating. But on the other hand, you're getting a dividend back. And so those who use less energy will be getting back more. And it happens that the poor use less energy. So the poor, under this situation, will be paying higher prices, but they will be getting back more, much more than that in a dividend. So this is what we are suggesting and proposing, and there are other people who are beginning to suggest it as well. But what people need to realize is that the debate is now going on. This is not theory, this is practice, and unfortunately everybody is saying we need to do this. But then when it comes to strategy, people are all over the place, and this, we're trying to engage the issue on its own terms.
The idea of being able to distribute those sort of, I guess the way we would refer to it almost as dividends, strikes me as something, and I'd read this too, about Alaska and essentially how it distributes some of these monies that come as royalties from the oil companies. Would you advocate a system that's similar to that in the way that the monies would come back?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. What Alaska did, you know, Alaska is based on oil, really, and it allows the oil companies to drill, and it gets royalties from that, and it puts a portion of those royalties, not all of them, but a portion of it, into a trust fund, essentially. And then the revenues from that trust fund are distributed every year in a check to every Alaskan. Who you have to have a certain residency there, but I don't think it's very long in order to get one of those dividends. So yes, that's what one is talking about, and we have a mechanism for doing that. We have the income tax form, and for those people who don't file an income tax, they will start filing it in order to get their dividend back. We have something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a refundable tax credit. It means that if you don't have any tax liability, they send you a check. And that system was started 25 years ago, and there's a lot of people who now file an income tax form just to get that money, when previously they wouldn't, or they would just itemize their income taxes. So there is administratively, we can do this. I mean, none of this is going to be simple, but if we're serious about doing something, then we have to end up with some systemic, comprehensive emission reduction strategy. And I would argue that this is really the only way to guarantee that. And then we're talking about both the details and the philosophies attendant to it. In Europe, a couple years ago, Europe was the first to try this out. But what Europe did is they said, well, we have existing. They focused on the electricity sector, and they said, well, we have existing carbon dioxide emissions that come from the utility sector. So what we're going to do is we're going to allocate freely, we're going to give these polluters the amount of carbon dioxide permits that they now emit. And then every year, then, we're going to require them to reduce their emissions. Well, what happened is that they took those permits and they sold them on the open market. They made billions of dollars, and they did virtually nothing in terms of reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. And so Europe is revisiting and revising that plan, and most people are now talking about auctions. That is where you really literally have to buy these things, and they're not just given away to polluters because they've been polluting all the time.
Realistically, we look at this from an administrative standpoint. As you said, this can work. What about the political will to actually put this in place from a policy standpoint?
Well, I don't know about that. We will have to see. But in Minnesota, we passed a law just 3 months ago that set up a task force that has to report back to the legislature and present strategies as of next February, present strategies that can get us to an 80% reduction in our statewide greenhouse gas emissions within 35 years and a 10% reduction within just a few years. We're doing that. California is coming out with the second iteration of its greenhouse gas reduction plan. New York has one. The New England states have developed one. So we're going to do something, and the question is whether we're going to do it right or not, and whether we're going to do it comprehensively or whether we're going to do it incrementally. But you're asking really a larger question, and the larger question is, are we willing politically to save ourselves? And I don't know the answer to that question. that's good. That's the $64,000 question. The human species has the capacity to conceptualize the future, and also the capacity to do nothing about it. And so we'll see which wins.
That's an interesting twin capacities there, isn't it? Dr. David Morris, Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, you've been very kind with your time, our guest in this portion of our program. Earlier in the discussion, you mentioned a website that some people listening to us may want to visit for further information. Would you repeat that, please?
Yes, it's very easy. New Rules. New Rules, one word, .org, and that's the website, and it's information rich, and it provides people with information on what communities are doing and states are doing, and actual policies, that is the actual wording of legislation and regulations and tax policies that people can sort of download from there and introduce in their city councils and county commissioner offices and state legislatures and make the conversation much more concrete. So rather than say, we should do something, you could say, let's do this.
And I assume there are examples you've heard of where people are doing that exact same thing.
Absolutely. About 80 to 90% of the rules that we have on the website are rules that have been enacted in at least one jurisdiction.
Thank you so much for joining us on our program.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you learn all kinds of things on this program, don't you? Thank you to David Morris for joining us and sharing some of that information, some information on energy issues, very important information, and also gave us some specific ideas about the idea of citizen action as well. It's a topic that we will be watching, and we'll consider him a resource to be tapped in the future as well.